Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is attorney and mediator Mariette Geldenhaus. Geldenhaus studied law and criminology at Oxford University, where she was a Rhodes Scholar. She is a graduate of the University of Pretoria, South Africa, and for over 24 years she has practiced law in the Ithaca, New York region. 10 years ago, she shifted the focus of her practice to collaborative law and mediation. She is currently vice president of the Finger Lakes Women's Bar Association and a member of the New York State Bar Association Committee on LGBT People and the Law. The focus of our interview today will be LGBT family law and gay marriage, which Geldenhaus has spent many years navigating and has much expertise in. And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish.
Now, I want to begin with a personal talk about how did you get into the law? I always wonder how people follow these kinds of passions.
I think growing up as a child in South Africa, even though when you're a young child, you're not as aware of the environment around you, I was still quite young when I started realizing that there was a lot of injustice in the society. And I think I always had a strong inherent sense of fairness. And growing up seeing so much injustice around me, I think it was my way of trying to find a mechanism or a process or a career where I could help right injustice and help people who are being oppressed or treated unfairly to find some kind of remedy.
Wow, that's a really honorable reason to get into law. I haven't heard that one. Now you've immersed yourself in LGBT issues even before the gay marriage issue started coming onto the horizon. What kind of issues were you dealing with prior to the gay marriage issue?
Well, when I first started practicing in Ithaca here in the 1980s, I realized that at that point in New York State and in much of the United States and the world, there really were no legal protections for gay and lesbian couples, for transgendered persons, and that couples really were at great risk if one of them died, if something happened to their relationship. There were absolutely no legal protections out there. And I was concerned about that. So I started drafting documents and coming up with ways that they could protect their relationship as best they could in a hostile legal environment. Mm. And back then, I actually designed a class that I taught at BOCES. They still had the adult education series in the evenings.
Oh, yeah.
So for years, I taught legal issues for unmarried couples, LGBT as well as straight unmarried couples, to try and educate people. That was my main goal, to make people aware of the deficits in the legal system and also help them find some ways to protect each other and protect their relationship and their children.
Well, obviously the evolution of gay marriage started with domestic partnerships. A lot of states allowed that, a lot of companies, a lot of organizations.
Right. That's right.
So to tell us a little bit about what protections people did have and how it's evolved, we'll get into that. About gay marriage.
Yes, the evolution has been very interesting because it started out as a movement, as you said, for domestic partnerships and civil unions in some states. Actually, it started back in Hawaii, where marriage just became legal in the last couple of weeks, where civil unions were enacted to give some protection. I think in the beginning, it was unthinkable that same-sex couples would be able to marry.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So just the thought of it just seemed preposterous.
Even in the gay community. I mean, when I was involved in the gay community, nobody talked about it. People scoffed at it, a lot of them.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember back 20, 25 years ago, somebody even mentioned the possibility. People would laugh out loud. And I mean judges, lawyers, you know, not just the person on the street.
Yeah.
So, but there was also a sense in some quarters that this wasn't really fair, and that if a gay or lesbian couple was in a committed relationship, it should be possible to give them some protection.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the concept of a civil union evolved, which ended up being separate and unequal.
Absolutely.
It was an effort to provide some redress, but in the end, it created more problems than
itself. Yeah, and I have often told people that's separate but unequal, because you still had to go through all these hoops to be able to enact some of these things that married people take for granted. And people forget how recent this was. That was 1997 when Hawaii enacted domestic partnerships. It's quite recent.
It is very recent, and I'm still amazed, immersed as I am in in this work that how much things have accelerated and how quickly the momentum has built in the last really 15 years on this issue.
Yeah, it has been amazing. I had so many people tell me 10 years ago it won't happen in my lifetime. And then here we are. We're almost there.
Clients that I recently met with actually told me that I told them 15 years ago that I didn't think New York State would allow marriage for same-sex couples in my lifetime. So I've happily had to eat my words.
Yeah, I think all of us have. Now, let's go back to the fact that, I mean, most of us remember DOMA, which was a major setback for all of us. And it was something that President Clinton signed in 1996. Tell us about how that was a barricade for all of us.
Oh, DOMA was really a tremendous setback because what DOMA did was it said that the federal government would not recognize a marriage even if it's legal in a state. DOMA was precipitated by Hawaii, where it looked like marriage was a possibility. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of concern, and I would even call it panic.
I was going to say panic,
Yeah. And so this was a preemptive strike, basically saying that the federal government would not recognize marriages even if people are legally married in their states. And it went further, and there's another section of DOMA, Section 2, which is still in effect and on the books, which says even if you're married in one state, other states do not have to recognize your marriage. Both those provisions are blatantly unconstitutional under the United States Constitution, but in the climate at the time, that didn't stop Congress or the president from signing the law. Yeah. So it was a huge setback. What that meant is that until June of this year, couples who were married in states like Massachusetts and since 2011, New York and others that allowed marriage still had this really bizarre dichotomy where the state says you're married, but the federal government says you're not. So that had lots of practical consequences. Like you had to file your state taxes as married, but you had to file your federal taxes as single, which meant preparing several different returns to figure out how to do this.
Yeah.
Being able to get state benefits, for example, if a spouse died, you would be the heir along with children, but you wouldn't get Social Security benefits because that's governed by the federal government.
It made it so complicated, too. What about adoption? What about children in this atmosphere of DOMA?
The situation with children, again, it's to this day, there's a real patchwork around the country. New York is one of the earlier states that allowed second parent adoption, meaning if one parent is the biological parent of the child, then that person's partner can adopt the child to make them both legal parents.
Mm-hmm.
So in New York, second parent adoption started in the 80s, and then there was a case that went up to the Court of Appeals in New York in the 90s. Unfortunately, the Court of Appeals approved second parent adoption. So it's been possible in New York and several other states for the non-biological parent to become a legal parent.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still many states, even today, that don't allow that. And the consequence of that is, let's say a lesbian couple has a child. One of them becomes pregnant by artificial insemination. They have a child. They plan to have the child together. They raise this child from birth. In every respect, they're both full parents of this child. 6 years later, they separate. The biological mother is able to say, I'm sorry, you're never going to see this child
again. And we've seen the result of that. We've seen these cases.
They're heartbreaking, and they're not good for children. If you ask that six-year-old, who are your parents, you'll get a very unequivocal answer.
Mm-hmm.
But the legal system doesn't support that. So there are places, even states that don't allow marriage, that will allow second-parent adoption. But the interesting thing is now in the states like New York and others where marriage is allowed, people are under the misconception that they don't have to do second parent adoptions again. But they do, because even though if you live in New York State, for example, and during the marriage a child is born, there's a presumption legally that both parents are the parents. But if you move to another state that doesn't recognize your marriage, then your parentage is also not recognized.
Oh, it's so complicated, isn't it?
It's unbelievably complicated.
It's so anti-family. You know, all these people who, many conservatives in this country say they're opposed to gay marriage, but it's so anti-family.
You know, if you read the Windsor decision, Justice Kennedy's decision, he really emphasizes the children and the impact on the thousands and thousands of children of same-sex couples and how they're at a disadvantage because of the discrimination against them and their parents.
Yeah. What did you think in 2001, the Netherlands became the first country in the world to legalize marriage? Did a lot of Americans try to get married there? Did it have any legal validation in this country when people were doing that?
Not not significantly. Of course, there was celebration, and it was a huge sense of hope for people.
Oh, it was amazing.
Yes, it made the impossible seem possible. Not too many U.S. couples, to my knowledge, went to the Netherlands to get married. The really big shift came when Canada legalized marriage. Mm-hmm. And I think also just because of where we're located here in Ithaca, we're near Canada. So within 3 hours, people could be in Canada and get married.
Yeah, and I remember a lot of people did do that. And in your country, South Africa, legalized marriage before we ever did,
yes,
in 2006.
Yes, 2006. Yeah. That was hugely significant. And I love to say how I never thought I would use South Africa as an example in the United States of advancing civil rights, but that's exactly what happened.
I was surprised by South Africa, too. I mean, the Netherlands, I expected.
Yes, you know, I mean, they tend to be on the forefront of social change.
And the extremely progressive side.
Yes, yes. South Africa's interesting because in 1990, the new constitution was negotiated, and that constitution explicitly includes sexual orientation as a class protected from discrimination. So it's really inevitable that same-sex marriage would be approved there by the highest court, the Constitutional Court, because the constitution explicitly protects LGBT people.
Yeah.
And it's the only constitution in the world, to my knowledge, that does that. If we had that in the United States, the issue would be resolved instantly, but we don't, of course.
Yeah. Have you lawyers, or you specifically, used some of the precedent in some of these other countries to try to push it in this country? Examples and so
absolutely.
On?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So when we did the Ithaca 50 case here in Ithaca...
I remember that.
Yes, it was three of my colleagues and I represented 25 same-sex couples in Ithaca pro bono to ask the courts in New York State to rule that there was a fundamental right to marry and that they should be allowed to marry. And in that case, in our briefing to the court, we mentioned all the other countries that had marriage. Massachusetts at that time had marriage. So even though in this country court decisions or laws in other states are not binding, it certainly is worth noting that, so that you know, when you hear arguments like marriage historically has always been between a man and a woman, and this is not even conceivable, it's always helpful to let people know that things are shifting and there are places in the world where there's a different perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's bring us to this great bombshell of a woman named Edith Windsor, who started this lawsuit against the United States because of her marriage not being recognized, her marriage in Canada. Mm-hmm. To tell us Edith's story. She's an amazing woman.
She's incredible. She is just so strong and feisty and determined. Her case was such a sympathetic case. She and her wife, Thea, had been together for many, many decades. And Thea had MS, and Edie had taken care of her for many years. Mm-hmm. Shortly before Thea's death, I think within the last year or two of her life, they ended up going to Canada to get married. And at that time, Thea was already quite ill, but they managed to get there and to get married. This was so important to them to have this legal recognition of their decades-long relationship. After Thea died, because their marriage was not recognized on the federal level because of DOMA, Section 3 of DOMA, that say the federal government will pretend like you're not married even though you are, the federal government imposed a $323,000 estate tax bill, which would have been a real hardship for Edie to pay. And the reason that their estate was subject to this estate tax is they'd lived in Greenwich Village for decades, and the property that they owned there had appreciated manyfold. So this was such a clear injustice that this couple had been together for decades would be subject to this enormous estate tax, whereas an opposite sex couple in exactly the same situation would pay nothing, because between spouses there's a complete exemption from estate tax.
If you're just joining us, my guest is attorney Mariette Gildenhous. We're talking about the issue of gay marriage, for which Gildenhous has much expertise and much experience. We're talking about the Edith Windsor case that actually started the whole gay marriage train for many of us. Can you continue talking about her? So her spouse, Thea, left her this property when she died.
Yeah, so basically she was assessed this huge estate tax and then decided to pursue the case. And the case was filed in federal court in New York. At that point, there were several cases pending in different federal courts in different parts of the country. There were cases in Massachusetts and a few other states. And so the Windsor case and a couple of cases from Massachusetts went to the first level federal courts. And in the Windsor case, the New York court said that Section 3 of DOMA, which prohibits the federal recognition of marriages, is unconstitutional on equal protection grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Because under the U.S. Constitution, of course, equal protection is enshrined as one of the rights in the Constitution. So it was said that it's unequal treatment of same-sex couples to not recognize their marriages. So there was a favorable ruling on the first level and in Massachusetts cases. So then this was appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And of the cases pertaining to Section 3 of DOMA that came before the Supreme Court, this is the case they picked to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And on which the Windsor decision that came down in June of this year was based.
It's absolutely amazing. Everybody I know was sitting in front of the TV intensely watching to
yes.
see what was going to happen.
It was riveting.
It was.
Because just the discourse in the court had shifted so much. There had been the Lawrence v. Texas case about a decade earlier. And even though that was a favorable decision, it didn't address the issue of marriage for same-sex couples. And the language and the discourse in the courts had just really shifted to being much more respectful. I still remember when I was city attorney in the late 1990s here in Ithaca, there was another marriage case that made its way through the courts. This was brought by a couple, actually against the advice of the national organizations who have promoted marriage.
Mm.
Because we all thought that the time was just not right. Not that we didn't all support the issue, of course,
uh-huh.
but we thought the time was not right. And so they ended up in an appellate court, and the city of Ithaca took the position at that time that the state of New York should be part of the lawsuit, and because they weren't, the case should be dismissed. We were really trying to be very careful that it not be addressed on the merits, but on a technical ground, so we wouldn't have a negative decision on the merits.
Uh-huh.
And I still remember that argument on that case vividly. The court really didn't have to talk about the merits. It was really about this technical issue. Were all the people who were supposed to be in the court there or not? And so it was an easy off-ramp in a way to say, you know, everybody's not here. The state was not included. And I still remember the judge who was presiding that day just making statements such as, so what's next? Do you think you're going to be wanting to marry an animal?
Oh my
and
God.
It took every ounce of composure I had to just say nothing, and I think my nail marks are still on the counsel table of that courtroom. So we went from that to when we argued the Ithaca 50 case in New York in the appellate court, where even though the court did not agree that there's a fundamental right to marry in New York, and that was really a crushing decision, the tone was very different.
Yeah,
it was respectful. Yeah. It was really confined to the legal issues, and there was none of the homophobic language vilifying the people involved. So there really has been a tremendous
Yeah, people
shift.
Have evolved. Yeah, it really is. It's a huge change from the 70s when I was involved in LGBT issues
sure,
in San Francisco and San Luis Obispo.
Now,
of course, the Edith case did strike down part of DOMA, but as you said earlier, Section 2 is still being enacted around the
yes.
country, right? So give us a little bit more of an overview of what that means.
Yeah, sadly, Section 2 is alive and well. Now, the decision by the attorneys and the organizations such as Lambda Legal Defense and the National Center for Lesbian Rights and GLAAD in Massachusetts to confront Section 3 of DOMA first was a very deliberate decision, because it seemed that the Windsor case and other cases were really sympathetic cases, and doing this one section at a time had a better chance of success. And of course, they turned out to be right
mm-hmm.
because of the Windsor decision and the win on striking down Section 3. Section 2 basically is in violation of what's called the Full Faith and Credit Clause of the United States Constitution. What that means is that if there's a marriage in one state or there's a court decision, then all the other states have to recognize it. And there's a really simple reason for that. Otherwise, we'd have chaos.
I was going to say, it seems so logical.
Yes. And that clause is in the Constitution so that you won't have chaos. So really, this provision of Section 2 of DOMA saying that states can pick and choose whether they want to recognize some kinds of marriages and not other kinds of marriages is unconstitutional, but it still needs to be challenged. And that will happen. I think that's going to be the next challenge in terms of LGBT marriage rights for states who refuse to recognize the marriage of a couple that's legally married in another state.
So do you think somebody's in the process as we speak of perhaps?
There are cases in the pipeline, yes.
Mm.
None of them have, there are no decisions yet, but there are cases in the pipeline in several places in the United States. Because now we have the opposite bizarre situation from what we had before. So before, as I mentioned, say you lived in New York, you're married in New York, your marriage is considered valid by the state, but the federal government says no, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. Now, for purposes of many of the federal benefits or federal laws, let's say you came to New York, you had a wonderful weekend in New York City, you got married, you went back to Kentucky, which doesn't recognize your marriage. Mm-hmm. The federal government will still consider you married for many purposes, but the state of Kentucky says, no way, you're not married.
Yeah.
So now the opposite situation applies. And it's not just strange. It's really disruptive to people in their lives and makes their lives more complicated. For example, the IRS has come down with a ruling now that if you're married, if you're a same-sex couple and you're married, then you have to file as married for your federal income taxes.
I heard that, yeah.
Right. So, but a lot of the non-recognition states have now come out and said, well, Section 2 of DOMA, we're not going to recognize that. So now people have to file as single on the state level, but your state return is based on your federal return. So then you have to prepare another federal return if you were single and then base your state return on that, which is just chaos.
It is. Well, I can see how it could be chaos, not even just in regard to those kinds of things. But, you know, I mean, if a couple got married in New York and one of the members of the couple had a family in Kentucky mm-hmm. who was totally aghast, and if they visited and somebody, you know, the spouse died, I mean, would the family have claim on the surviving spouse?
Potentially, yes, absolutely, because, you know, it's a very risky proposition for same-sex couples to travel to non-recognition states with their children. There was a terrible case in Florida where a couple went there with their child or two children, and one of them had an aneurysm and was in the emergency room and died in the hospital. And her partner and children were not allowed to see her because Florida did not recognize their parentage. It did not recognize their relationship. So heartbreaking things like that happen.
Oh, absolutely heartbreaking. Yeah. Geez. So where do you think we are now? I mean, are we eventually going to have to go back to the Supreme Court to enable to see gay marriage nationally in this country?
I think so. The Supreme Court had the opportunity to deal with this issue once and for all in the Perry v. Hollingsworth case, which is the California case, you know, the history of California where
Prop 8.
Prop 8. Mm-hmm. So marriage rights were granted by the court, taken away by Prop 8. And then there was this lawsuit filed in California under the federal constitution. And the Supreme Court decided not to decide the merits, not to decide the actual issue of marriage in that case. They sidestepped it for now.
Yeah, they did. They did.
Yeah. Which on the one hand is disappointing, on the other hand is understandable. I think they probably felt that all the states that don't have marriage aren't ready for this. But I think the logical conclusion has to be eventually that the Supreme Court will rule that there's a fundamental right to marry, to give equal protection to all the citizens in the country. Same-sex couples need to be allowed to marry.
Yeah,
so that's
eventually
what's going to happen, but I think I'm reluctant to predict how long it will take because I've fortunately been wrong in having overestimated the time it's taken us to get this far.
Yeah.
But I think there will be a lot of litigation from separate states that will be bubbling up, and eventually some of those cases will go to the Supreme Court. And I think if you read the Windsor decision, it really does pave the way for that broader decision. What's very interesting, if you read Justice Antonin Scalia's dissent, he basically says, well, the next logical step is marriage across the board. And he even basically writes the brief for that case. He says, if you take this decision, you take out a few words and amend them, it makes the case for marriage. And I think he's right. So eventually that's going to happen.
Yeah, that was kind of a crazy undermining dissent on his part in some ways.
It was interesting,
yes.
It was certainly interesting.
So, you know, almost every week we hear about another state that's enacted gay marriage, you know, Hawaiians. So what if all 50 states did that? We'd still have to have a federal enactment, correct? Or would it just be automatic?
If all states enacted marriage either legislatively or through a court decision, whereby the state's highest court says under the state's constitution you have to allow marriage, and if all states recognized marriages from all other states, the Supreme Court wouldn't have to act, the federal government wouldn't have to act, because at that point Section 2 of DOMA would just be obsolete.
Mm.
If no states chose to refuse recognition. Section 2 doesn't say you have to refuse recognition, just says you can if you want to.
Uh-huh.
So if states all voluntarily stopped doing that, then it wouldn't be necessary. But my sense is that would just take too long for each of the 50 states.
Yeah, I would think so, too. But, you never know what's going to happen. Yeah. I wouldn't predict anything either. Yeah.
Yes. The momentum is definitely building. And a lot of the states that have their own constitutional amendments prohibiting marriage, the opposition is getting really, really even more intense and nastier. And to me, that's a sign that victory is near, because I think the opponents are realizing that the momentum is building and their case is getting weaker and weaker.
Yeah, and the future is upon us.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about divorce laws in regard to LGBT couples. Are they the same, or is that another thing that's still being worked out?
In the states that recognize marriage, divorce laws are the same. So if, sadly and unfortunately, some of the same-sex couples who marry decide that they need to divorce, then the same laws apply. There are a couple of differences, though. Same-sex couples often marry when they've been together for quite a while.
Yeah.
Because marriage wasn't available at the beginning of their relationship when they first got together. So the divorce laws aren't a good fit for them, because it will only treat their marriages from when they were legally married and the property that they accumulated together from that point forward as shared, whereas they really have a relationship of maybe 25 years and they were only married for two. So for that reason, it's really a good idea for same-sex couples to think about doing a prenup and spelling out how they view their relationship and their rights. Because a lot of same-sex couples that I've worked with want to actually broaden what they consider their joint property because they're honoring their relationship.
Uh-huh.
Other couples, because they have figured out their own way of running their relationship, when they find out what the state laws are about marriage, they're aghast and they don't like it. So they can opt out of a lot of those things.
Uh-huh.
You know, the one that seems to really get people is finding out that they could be liable for the other person's debts, even if they didn't know about them.
Absolutely.
They're not liable to the creditor, but if you accumulate debt while you're married and you get divorced, then the total accumulated debt is marital debt that can be allocated to both spouses.
Yeah, so, I've heard some of my heterosexual friends have gone through those kinds of problems.
Right. Yeah, I happen to think a prenuptial agreement, or at least a discussion about one, is a good idea for any couple getting married. Because really, when you get married, you're signing a contract, whether you know it or not, and you get the one-size-fits-all contract from the state unless you think about it and decide that you want to customize it to your own situation.
Yeah,
so that's one difference. The other difference, and this is, alas, another byproduct of the non-recognition in a lot of states. Couples do travel from non-recognition states, or states that don't have marriage, to states that do. New York City is a very popular marriage venue, for example. And now destination weddings in Hawaii, I'm sure, will pick up. Then they go home, and their state doesn't consider them married, which has, of course, problems during their relationship, as we have already discussed. But should they, in the end, separate and decide to get a divorce, they can't. Because their state says marriage, what marriage? The state where they were married and all the states that recognize marriage do consider their marriage rights.
Mariette Gildenhaus, we are almost out of time. Can you think of anything that you wanted to say to people in regard to trying to get this issue moving forward? Can anybody do anything?
I think what's really made a huge difference in the last two or three decades is education and people just getting to know people who are gay and lesbian couples. So I think for gay and lesbian couples, it's really important to be out and open with their friends, with their neighbors, with the parents of other children who go to school with their children. And for those people who are straight allies, to be open about their support and to be encouraging of same-sex couples as they continue the struggle for full marriage rights.
Great, great. Well, Mariette Gildenhaus, attorney, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great talking to you about this issue. Thank you.
Tish. It's been a pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.